Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Now, Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate, joins us. Hey, Mark, welcome back.
Good to be with you, John. Thank you.
Talk to me about these jobs numbers, sir.
Well, of course, we're awaiting the monthly jobs report in the morning, and that's expected to show a slowdown in hiring, but the unemployment rate at 3.6%. You go back and look at the data, we actually moved to 3.6% last March. So we've been largely marching in place, hitting 3.4% in January, the lowest in over 50 years. This morning, we had some revisions issued with new jobless claims that puts them at a higher level over the past couple of months than what we had thought. And that then makes a little more sense because the number of people filing for unemployment insurance is higher than what we thought. And, you know, with all the job cut announcements, we were wondering why we weren't seeing more of that. But, you know, broadly speaking, the job market still regarded as tight. We had job openings numbers released earlier in the week. That was still a high number coming down from record levels over the past year or so. So I still think there's opportunity out there. But, you know, when you're seeing sort of the worst flame out for the technology sector since the dot-com bubble, when you're seeing a slowdown in the housing market broadly across many markets across the country, obviously a welcome sign for prospective home purchasers. There are some areas of the economy that have been feeling the impacts of interest rate hikes over the past year. Manufacturing is another one of those areas.
You liken this to the dot-com bubble for the tech sector?
Well, it's absolutely the worst, you know, experience for that sector since that experience. But let's perhaps say that I don't think at this point it reaches that level of severity, but we're also continuing to work through it. You know, if you think about the huge way that we all leaned on technology solutions during the earliest days of the pandemic by necessity, some solutions sort of presented themselves, like the Zoom calls that we either use for work or perhaps at that time we're using to get in touch with friends and family. And then, you know, some of those companies sort of look now as to, hey, where's our next growth going to come from? And some of them are meeting some challenges, and some people are backing away from the utilization of some of these solutions as well. And of course, with the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, it's broadly thought that bank lending is going to become less prevalent. That means that with higher interest rates and less availability of credit, that can do what the Federal Reserve has been seeking to do, and that is take some of the steam out of the economy. And mm-hmm. Chairman Jerome Powell said as much at his most recent news conference that I attended.
So is NASDAQ down then? What's NASDAQ down for the year?
I haven't looked at those numbers lately, but, you know, essentially we're still talking. We had a good rebound for technology stocks in recent weeks and months. I think part of that was predicated on the expectation that the Fed does eventually say, hey, we're done with rate hikes. But certainty about that right now is not high with respect to the Fed, because if they sort of move on from where they were in emergency mode here recently with the financial system instability, they may continue to direct the bulk of their attention to inflation. And they did indicate at the last meeting that they might only have one more interest rate hike. But as we know, John, that's entirely dependent on the behavior of inflation, which has proven to be more persistent and more severe than had been thought. And we do have some Fed speakers now who are continuing to say, you know, inflation is the issue. If the severity of the financial system's woes, you know, seems to go back into that hole. So we're going to have to see. I will say, John, you know, we just published a series of stories of Bankrate about two different surveys. One was a survey of professional investors. The other was a survey of economists. And the investors do think that there's a better than 50-50 chance that we'll have the emergence of a new bull market in stocks before the end of the year. And that probably is predicated on a more accommodating Fed, which we don't have that promise just yet. But the economists also think that the job market will slow over the course of the next year or so. And they have once again ratcheted up their assessment of the risks of recession. materializing between now and the end of the year. But we don't know about the severity of that recession, even if it does show up.
So what's the relationship between a recession and a bull market?
Well, you're not going to have a bull market in the early stages of a recession typically, but let's say if it is one that's less than severe, and that's sort of the, I would say that's the consensus right now. At some point, investors begin to price in the emergence out of that recession as well.
Yeah.
And then you know, you're you know, off to the races with another bull market. But I think if we learned anything, John, whether it's from our perspective in the work that you and I do or just as individuals from everyday lives, uncertainty is kind of the watchword of this point in our history. And things do present themselves that can be both risks and opportunities. And we've got more volatility and uncertainty than probably we've seen in a long time. And that can be rattling for people. Maybe the most important takeaway from the business lunch perspective for those that are saving for their retirement, mm-hmm. It really dictates the need to be mindful on the long term, because based on history, you know, saving for retirement through investing and saving for emergencies, because those things do emerge from time to time as well, unexpected expenses. We just have to try to keep our noses to the financial grindstone and not worry about the headlines on a day-to-day basis, because as soon as they're gone, there'll be new headlines, right?
Yeah, well, that is for sure. And by the way, we just looked it up, and the answer to my question, what's the NASDAQ doing this year-to-date? NASDAQ is up 15%. That's more than I would have guessed. I'm also looking at some of the survey information you posted about how baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennials, et cetera, have different priorities in their jobs these days. We've heard this from the likes of Tom Gimbel, but you want to talk a little bit about that as well, Mark?
Yeah, I love the opportunity to talk about our job seeker survey, John. Thank you. We find that 56% of those in the workforce, that's those who are working or looking for work, plan to look for a new job in the next 12 months. And those numbers sort of skyrocket, as you suggested there, when you're talking about younger members. So this is 4 in 5 of Generation Z, that's age 18 to 26, planning to look for a new job in the next 12 months. And even millennials, which takes us all the way up to age 42, you have 61% of those planning to look for a job, while boomers, those 59 to, believe it or not, all the way up to 77 years of age, only about 1 in 4 plan to look for a new job. And to the question of priorities, I think that we're seeing some of the impacts of high inflation there, because we have many people prioritizing higher pay. That's about 1 in 3, whereas work-life factors are also up there. And just 1 in 4 are looking for more happiness at work, broadly speaking, less stressful work, more rewarding work, and 10% were prioritizing job security. So it's an interesting time, and that's going to be a challenge for managers when it comes to retention and hiring as well, if indeed even a good part of those people are successful.
Well, say you knock on your boss's door, or however it is you reach out to your boss these days, and you'd like something. Maybe you want to raise, maybe you want to work from home more, and you would trade the money for the flexibility. You know, you don't want to maybe go to both stores at once, so you're going to pick one. 61% of those 26 and younger, 61% of younger workers would go for more flexibility.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, and we know that these have become increasing priorities over the course of the pandemic, because we've learned a lot about the opportunity to have flexibility in certain kinds of jobs. You know, there's a restaurant I know where they got rid of the breakfast service they had just so they could give a shorter span of work to the entirety of their staff, or maybe they cut back on the hours they're open late. That's just one example. They can't give people the opportunity to work remote, of course, so they have to make adjustments where they can. And we know anecdotally, as well as from some actual data, that there's less working from home now than in recent months as more enterprises prioritize the benefits of being together in the office, whether it's cohesiveness or productivity, at least some balance there. But, you know, I don't know what it's like there in downtown Chicago, but having been to LA, New York, and Washington, I can tell you in those key business centers, some of those commercial office buildings look pretty hollowed out, and And that's another story.
Yeah, we've got that in Chicago, too. And then the restaurants you mentioned suffer as a result, although they suffer not so much for lack of customers. That's part of it for sure. But I also think they are having trouble getting and keeping people to work, wait tables. A friend of mine, his daughter works in a pretty nice restaurant downtown. And as a result, I think, the tips are great for her because she's not fighting. She must have more tables that she's tending to. She came home the other day with hundreds of dollars in cash tips, hundreds and hundreds of dollars in cash tips because she's working hard. There is an audience, maybe less, but there are fewer employees working, so she gets the lion's share.
Good for her. And, you know, I'd say she earns every penny of that. You know, there are some restaurants in suburban areas, for example, where, you know, they didn't know that they would have these lines of revenue opportunities for sales that have been created over the pandemic, where, you know, how many of these restaurants would have had takeout or delivery or had, you know, seats outside the restaurant. And so for some, this is actually, once they got past the nightmarish part of this, has been an opportunity for them to actually thrive if they're in the right location.
How about the percentage of people who are looking for a new job in the next 12 months? What a challenge that must be for employers then.
For sure. You know, we've seen an acceleration of job cut announcements from your own Chicago-based challenger, Gray and Christmas, and they tell us, of course, no surprise that that is coming from the technology sector more than anywhere else. And so, you know, I think that there are going to be businesses that are simply taking their job postings off their virtual job opening boards. There are going to be some that are going to cut the workers if they're not needing them either for meeting demand or their strategic purposes. And so I do think that some of these folks who are telling us that they will be looking for work, they're a bit concerned about their job security and perhaps in their own individual location, making a judgment about what that outlook is. But also, again, having not made progress in the tug of war against inflation since that began raging, while we have seen that turn to a more optimal equation here recently as inflation comes down and wages are going up, you know, people have lost ground. And so they're saying, well, there's one way for me to fix that. And the data suggests that those who change jobs are more likely to get bigger increases in pay than if they stick around.
Hey, one last thing. More people are putting more purchases or debt on their credit cards.
Right.
What are the rates these days?
Well, to start, 20% for the best qualified individuals, and then you just go up from there. My colleague Ted Rossman did a survey to find that store-branded credit cards, in terms of just as a class, can be in the 30% range. And of course, if one is not a well-qualified borrower, meaning they don't have a high credit score, don't have the best record in terms of paying their bills, that's where those credit card issuers are going to sort of assess what their risk is and then raise the rates accordingly. So, you know, the best advice we can give is please try to pay off these credit card balances when they essentially are accrued or before the next billing cycle hits, because that's when those interest charges come into play. And the counter to that, as we've talked about many times, John, is to have emergency savings, because our most recent survey found that 30% of Americans have more credit card debt than they have emergency savings. And that's, you know, that's the ultimate in struggles, and it's heartbreaking. And we hope that more people can make progress on that front.
Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst, Bankrate.com, Mark Hamrick. Nice to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.
You bet. Let's talk a little bit more on the Wintrust Business Lunch now with Matt Schultz, who is the Chief Credit Analyst at LendingTree.com. In fact, just a couple of minutes ago, Matt, we were talking to Mark Hamrick at Bankrate about the credit card debt that people are piling up. And you are talking and writing a little bit about BNPL loans, buy now, pay later, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what we've seen is that use of buy now, pay later is growing, although not as hockey stick style as we've seen in recent years. But what was most interesting in the report that we did was that we're finding that people are using it more as a bridge to their next paycheck and even for things like groceries.
What's the rate that you pay on one of those buy now, pay later loans?
Generally speaking, they're usually interest-free, especially for something that would be as inexpensive as groceries. And that's part of what makes them a really good deal. But the problem is that they're really easy to get. So people can end up piling these things on top of each other and running themselves into a fair amount of debt and making it difficult to manage.
Who offers these?
There are a bunch of firms. The most popular one is PayPal, but there are others, Affirm, Klarna, Afterpay are some of the big players in it. And we've even seen Apple jump into the fray recently with their offering called Apple Pay Later. So it's definitely something that people are using.
I understand I noticed that story, the Apple Pay Later. I kind of chuckled at first. I thought, is this a joke, Apple Pay Later? And that they didn't charge interest. I thought the at least upside for Apple would be, but you might be using it to purchase an Apple product, so they'll get the money, even if they have to float you for a little while. But if it's just a third party that doesn't seem to have any skin in the game, I don't see how that's a business model.
Well, that's been an interesting side of it, because with the meteoric growth of buy now, pay later, we have seen, especially as interest rates have risen over the last year, we've seen some reports about buy now, pay later companies struggling a little more financially. And I think that makes a whole lot of sense. But what we are seeing in terms of demand from consumers is still really high.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that. But I'm sorry, just one last thing about that business model then. Sure. How do they make their money? If they're not charging you interest, who's paying them?
Sometimes the merchants are paying them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's about fees and things like that. There's certainly plenty of ways where they are making their money, for sure.
And then can you talk a little bit about the demographics of these loans?
Yeah, what's interesting is that the people who are getting them most often are younger folks, so Gen Z. But we also see that men are using them more than women, and also it's not just folks with who are struggling to get to the next paycheck or who don't make a whole lot of income. We're also seeing folks who make $100,000 or more a year who are using these types of loans regularly. So it really is a phenomenon that is touching on all aspects of our society.
Well, it's an example of the more you get, the more you spend. I'm looking at the household income chart, and it goes up, 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 up. As income goes up, so too does the use of these loans. You'd think it would be the opposite of that, but evidently not.
Yeah, no, it is interesting, because one thing that we've seen is that just because you make a lot of money doesn't mean that you're not still living paycheck to paycheck or that you don't need help floating. So that's certainly the case with credit cards, but it's also the case with buy now, pay later as well.
For groceries, no less, huh?
Yeah, that's one of those that's really interesting, because when this whole phenomenon came around, it was primarily a thing about, like, you know, high-end shoes and purses and technology and stuff like that. But it's so ubiquitous now that you can use it for literally almost anything. And people are using them for the most fundamental of all purchases in groceries. And that's, it can be good because it's an interest-free way to do it, but the fact that people are having to borrow to buy groceries is troubling in and of itself.
Yeah, the adage that, well, if you need the loan, then don't buy it, but you don't have that luxury when it comes to food and gas. What happens when somebody is late with or misses a payment?
It can vary. Sometimes you will get hit with a late fee. Sometimes you are reported to a credit bureau, but not always. And then sometimes some of these lenders will basically just tell you that you won't be able to borrow from them anymore. Yeah. So it's a little less straightforward than you have with credit cards, but it's still something to avoid for sure.
Yeah, if you're late with a credit card, they say, hey, I got an idea, borrow more. They love that. maybe they don't, but I mean, at least they have some sort of reverse incentive there. So, this is always a better option than a credit card if you can do it, right?
It really depends on what you're looking for. I mean, anytime you can get an interest-free loan that's finite, that you don't have to worry about carrying over future debt, it's a good deal. But the fact that these things can be really easy to get and can make it to where it's a little more difficult to manage if you have a bunch of different payments that you have to make at the same time, that can be a little more challenging. And then there's things like rewards and some other consumer protections that credit cards come with, the BNPL doesn't.
LendingTree says 46%, 46 say they've used a buy now, pay later service, up from 43 a year ago, 31% the year before that. 31, 43, now almost half of us. That includes nearly two-thirds of Gen Zers and 55% of millennials. So there's a reminder of where we are and the stakes in the game right now. Matt Schultz is the chief credit analyst at LendingTree.com. Nice to talk to you today, Matt. Thanks for giving us your insight.
Thank you.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Asking prices for Chicago area homes hit a new high in late March. Cranes analyzed data from real estate marketplace Redfin and found the median asking price at about $333,500. Compared to last year, that figure is 1.1% higher and 2.4% above the highest recorded median asking price. The report says higher asking prices are directly related to the low number of homes on the market. Chicago Association of Realtors says there are about 17% fewer homes on the market compared to last year. The resiliency of the local housing market is also impacting median prices. Archer Daniels Midland is moving to boost revenue in its health and wellness sector. The company's announced a partnership with San Francisco-based Brightseed to develop products targeting gut microbiome. Brightseed uses artificial intelligence to uncover molecules in plants with links to human health. The size of ADM's investment hasn't been disclosed. ADM has already invested in the production of probiotics and postbiotics for humans and animals. The company plans to increase its investment in health and wellness from $500 million to $2 billion over the next decade. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, here we are, the Thursday before Easter, and Jim Gaffigan has a few thoughts about the holiday.
Easter, that's a weird tradition.
Easter, the day Jesus rose from the dead. What should we do?
How about eggs?
Well, to explain that connection is USDA history buff Ann Eflin, who says Easter got its start centuries before Christianity showed up.
Originally, it was a holiday that celebrated a Germanic goddess, the Saxon goddess Esther, or Easter. And she was the goddess of spring and fertility.
And eggs are all about fertility.
The Persians and Egyptians actually exchanged eggs that were decorated in spring colors as a way of celebrating the spring. The early Christians sort of adopted that.
Well, that helps explain why we dye Easter eggs, but how do those eggs magically show up on Easter morning? Mr. Gaffigan?
Don't worry, there's a bunny.
Here comes Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail.
Yeah, that bunny tradition goes again back to ancient Germany.
The German story is that there was a poor woman who had decorated eggs for her family to find during a famine, and that I think they were to sort of identify which were their eggs, and they had to search for them and find them. They found this nest of eggs and looked up. They saw a rabbit hopping away, and that's how they decided the rabbit had brought the eggs.
And this evolved into a tradition where kids would hide their hats and bonnets around the house or yard, and supposedly the bunny would leave eggs in them. But how did we get to candy eggs?
The transition from eggs to candy seems to have been the result of an advertising campaign near the end of the 1800s by a European candy company as a means of selling their candy Easter eggs.
Oh, yeah, of course. Once the market traders got hold of it, the tradition got further and further away from how it started. Speaking of candy, tomorrow in this space, we will talk about the Chicago connection to the Easter candy favorite, the jelly bean. From the farm to your belly, today is a trifecta. National Burrito Day, National Carbonara Day, and National Caramel Popcorn Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's visit a little bit now with Alex Bitter, who is the chief retail reporter at Business Insider. Alex, you're on GN. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know if you saw the editorial in the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, that went to great lengths to speak about the virtues of Starbucks and Howard Schultz. You've written a little bit about this as well. Talk to me about the position Starbucks is in with unions, employees, et cetera.
Right. So obviously, Starbucks has spent the last couple of years in contention with some of its employees about their desire to form unions at some stores, right? Starbucks is obviously a huge company. It has tens of thousands of stores around the world. But we're at the point now between where you have, you know, 200 to 300 stores in the United States that have voted to unionize. And that's something that the company has said it opposes. And Howard Schultz is an interesting figure in all this because obviously he's basically synonymous with Starbucks at this point. He was involved as CEO very early on, all the way back in the 80s, and he just quit his latest stint as CEO and obviously was in Washington, D.C., where I'm based, last week testifying before Congress about Starbucks's efforts with unions and kind of their response to those employees who decided to unionize.
Why do they want to unionize? Doesn't Starbucks pay minimum and above? Don't they give the employees health insurance? Don't they even subsidize college for some employees?
They do, absolutely. And it is true that when you look at some of those things you mentioned, whether it's pay, you know, reimbursement for college, that sort of thing, they are often ahead of similar jobs, right? If you go and work at a restaurant, you can't just expect all of those benefits anywhere you'd apply. But what a lot of these workers say is, look, those are great, and we're not opposed to that at all, but we want kind of either more benefits in some cases or just security, right? Because that's something that Starbucks doesn't offer is, you know, kind of a progressive discipline process, for instance. You know, you can, as it is, technically right now, Starbucks can fire you because of whatever reason a manager decides, right? And there's not really a lot of effort, they say, into like documenting, like, well, you were, this is a pattern of behavior over time, right? And so there are, even if you kind of look at the economic benefits and the pay and say, well, those are pretty good, some of these employees say that there are other, maybe even non-economic, non-monetary benefits that they're looking for.
Seems like the youngest generation of workers have the greatest expectations from their employers and jobs. It's the reverse of what it used to be, say, or is now with older generation workers. And lo and behold, those are the people that are most often behind the counter, are the baristas. So he, it sounds like, has this population of people who can be great employees, but also require a lot of management finesse. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's true to an extent. It is worth mentioning, and I mentioned this in my piece that I published last week. It's interesting to look at kind of, do Americans support unions as a whole? That was a key stat we cited.
Yeah.
And if you go back to the 90s, right, according to Gallup, right, who's famous for their polling, it was just under 50% of Americans said they supported labor unions as a concept. And last year, when Gallup ran the same survey, that was up to 71. So that's a pretty considerable run-up in the support for these sorts of efforts. But to your point, I think Gen Z, younger folks, those people are particularly supportive of labor unions based on the polling that's out there. And you're correct. That is a key demographic, right, for Starbucks in terms of recruiting employees and keeping its stores staffed. So, you know, on the one hand, we've seen support for labor unions grow among everybody, basically. But it's also true that kind of the most fervent, the most supportive, probably out of everyone in society, are younger folks who are the people who are making your Frappuccino when you go to Starbucks.
I think a postscript to the pandemic is that, oh, yeah, right, employers weren't treating employees as well as they could have. And now that the tide has changed a little bit, employers find themselves behind the eight ball. But why is Congress asking Schultz these questions? What's the point of a congressional hearing with him?
Yeah, so I think that was a question that a lot of people were asking last week when Howard Schultz went before Congress. And I guess the short answer is, you know, there's nothing. Congress wasn't going to do anything directly about this. And I don't think there's going to be, you know, Bernie Sanders, really his goal was to get Howard Schultz in front of Congress to answer questions. And I think the biggest impact, if there is one, from that hearing will be the fact that we're talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, that was in the news cycle, and it got more attention, public attention, on both this unionization effort at Starbucks and particularly Howard Schultz's response to it, right? I think probably, you know, if you look at the statements that Senator Sanders made in the run-up to that hearing, he made it clear that he thinks Starbucks has done a few things wrong, to put it mildly, in terms of allowing these workers a choice to unionize, and then also negotiating contracts, right? That's the other big thing is, and maybe this also answers your question, there are a lot of shops, a lot of stores that have unionized, but not one of them has signed a contract with Starbucks, right? And, you know, forming a union for these folks is just the first step. Their ultimate goal is to get what we talked about earlier, right? Right, better rights on the job, better pay, perhaps, formalized in a contract. And something that Bernie made clear in the run-up to the hearing last week was there's been not a single contract. So I think that was probably another goal, was to highlight that and remind folks that, you know, we all talk about unionizing at Starbucks, but that's not the end goal. A contract is.
Alex, better stories in businessinsider.com. You'll love the headline. Starbucks' Howard Schultz was the gold standard for good bosses everywhere. Then Gen Z worked for him. And that's what we're talking about. It's well done, Alex. It's nice to talk to you today. Thanks for giving us your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.